You're listening to The Dice Men Cometh, proudly sponsored by Area 52, Tasmania's largest independent pop culture retailer. Find them at 104 Elizabeth Street, Hobart, or online at area52.com.au.
The Dice Men Cometh!
Hello again, everyone. It's me, Mark, here with another fascinating game designer interview. This time, I'm speaking with Matthew Dunstan, the Australian living abroad. He's got lots to say, including all about his latest games, Eurovision, World Cup, and Spiel des Jahres predictions, and I hope you really enjoy it.
So here I am, revisiting an old friend from the past, one of our first interviews on The Dice Men Cometh, way back in 2014, on episode 39, was Matthew Dunstan. Now, for those who don't know, Matthew, or Matt, is an Australian board game designer, currently living in Cambridge, in England, where he works as a research scientist in materials chemistry, of all things. And playing and designing games, of course, tends to distract him often from that goal. So, Matt, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me again today.
My pleasure, Mark. It's nice to be back. I didn't realise it was that long ago, actually. So
it's great for us to have been around that long. You know, we're in our fifth year now. But you were definitely one of our first, and you know, you don't forget your first. Now, I wanted to ask you, so are you still enjoying Cambridge?
Yeah, so I've been here almost 7 years now, and I've moved on from doing my PhD now to working as a postdoctoral researcher. But yeah, I still enjoy it. It's a nice place to live. I lived in Sydney before when I was in Australia, and I think I had enough of a very, very large city. So it's nice to be able to walk to work and things like that. So I've been enjoying it. And on the game design side, there's a really great community in the UK generally, but also in Cambridge especially. And there's been a lot of fruitful collaborations that have come out of that. So I think I've been very lucky in that way.
Lovely. Now, I want to take you back to the distant past. Now, I know in your bio on your blog, you mentioned that an aunt decided to teach you chess during a visit to the beach one time. Now, are there other games you remember from your youth? And do you think that any of those have been an influence on any of your new games?
Oh, that's an interesting question. What I really remember, really just more traditional games, so yeah, the chess story, but I loved playing cards, just traditional card games, 500, Euchre. I used to be a lines person at the Medibank International, although I don't know what it's called now, and I even did the Australian Open once. And I know we would just play cards all the time when you're waiting while it's raining or you're waiting for a match or something. So I think that was sort of what would define my really earliest experiences with gaming and, of course, Monopoly and everything. In thinking about how that might influence my current designs, I think I would love to make a trick-taking game that captures that sense of teamwork and where the game is simple enough that you can play it lots and lots of times. I mean, I think things like Teach You have achieved that. So it would be great if I could make something in that vein. But I think every time I've tried, you always feel like there's just so many, in that particular category especially, there's a lot of games and it's hard to kind of stand out or know what you're doing that's new or things like that. So I'd love to get to that.
Yeah, there are a lot of them around, that's for sure. Not many really rise above the level of something like Teach You. But you're right, a game like 500 that you can just play over and over and over and over is fantastic. Now,
have you played five-handed 500?
I don't think so.
That's the secret. Not a lot of people know about five-handed 500, but actually, so I'm assuming you're familiar with 500, and maybe the listeners aren't, I'm not sure, but 500 is usually a partnership game, a little bit like bridge, where you play in pairs. But you can play with five players where you essentially are trying to bid for your, not just for what sort of contract you're going to be playing, but you also bid for your partner. And what happens is as you play, you don't actually know who your partner is until it's sort of revealed during the play. It's really interesting and a dynamic way to sort of, you have sort of these shifting alliances, and whether you find out early in the play or really just on the last trick, you might find out who was actually working with you all along, or maybe you didn't have anybody else. So I definitely recommend checking that out if you're a 500 player. It's a fun, sorry, that was a bit of a diversion.
No, that's great. I was just thinking, actually, you know what came to mind for me? Something along the spy themed, where you've got spies and double agents and all that. And like you said, you don't really know who's on your side and who's not until almost the final reveal. You can have that one for free.
Yeah, there have been a few. There was a trick-taking game called Ebes that was released in Essen a few years ago, E-B-B-E-S. It changed how the game played depending as how cards were played during the round. So I think some people have looked at that. It's definitely one I have noodled with before, but haven't kind of found the perfect shell.
Just for our listeners, a little bit of history, as we said, we talked a lot about Relic Runners last time because that was where you came onto the gaming scene, and that came from Europa Ludi. Now, do you still compete or have an interest in Europa Ludi?
I think actually Europa Ludi never was run again, actually. I think it only existed that one year. It was sort of a amalgamation of two separate design competitions in France and in Spain, and this one year they decided to sort of put them together. But I think since they've sort of gone back to formally, you know, having separate competitions in those two countries.
Ah, well, that segues perfectly.
Okay.
Because clearly, if there's no Europa Ludi anymore, now is the time for you, Matthew, to get your dream of Ludivision out there.
Yes. Oh, wow. I don't know where you found that. But yes, I keep every time. So I'm a huge Eurovision fan, as I'm hopefully some of your listeners are. I'm not sure anyone who has the unfortunate thing to follow me on Twitter or something. But I keep coming back to this idea that it would be great to have some fun board game geek competition. But also, I think now, even more so than, say, 5 years ago, more and more countries are making games. There are more designers from different countries. There are more publishers from different countries, distributors. And I think it could be a chance. I mean, a bit like how Eurovision is. It's sort of a celebration of diversity, but also, you know, kind of what brings people together. So, I'd love that, if you could have, a small Australian, that we could select an Australian representative game for the year, and, each country could do that. And then there'd be some sort of, popular voting or something. Obviously you get into all the Eurovision voting.
Yes.
Maybe, but I would see it just more as an opportunity to, I think, celebrate just how widespread the hobby is and be another way for people to really discover new games. Because I think you focus on, the larger countries, maybe with wider distribution, or, English speaking countries, if you're in Australia or things like that. There are a lot of really interesting things being done in these sort of more, I guess, unknown countries in gaming, and it would be a great way to sort of celebrate that. And I think you would get in that kind of explore what's being done. I mean, you could imagine, what would be the Japanese game, for example? What would that be that they would put on it? And how would that be different for the German game or in Brazil, for example? There's a lot of publishers popping up, or in Estonia or in other places like this. So I think that would be a lot of fun. I unfortunately, just like a lot of my things, I have a lot of ideas and I talk about them and don't actually follow through. But if anyone out there is willing to work with me to make this thing a reality, I'd really love to do it at some point.
Well, I mean, I know we've talked to Phil Walker Harding, and he's told us the story about how Imhotep came out of I think it might have been a German competition in 2010 where he first put that forward. I can't remember. Maybe it was even Italian. But clearly these competitions are great for unearthing gems. Now, I want to stay on Eurovision for a moment. Now, it seems like you're talking about, the attraction of, the world coming together is there. Now, you've kept this up while you've been in England?
I have. I mean, and it's even better because you actually get to watch it live, which, in Australia, you always had to either stay up to some ridiculous hour or tune off social media. And also, I've sort of coincided with Australia starting to compete since I've been over here. So that obviously adds a new sense of, you can barrack for someone, you're actually your own country. And that brings, and of course, I live in the UK, so I can still vote for Australia. So
yes.
It's a perfect thing. But it's actually a great month for me in May, because you always have Eurovision and you always have the UK Games Expo. So it's sort of this perfect time. And for me, it's still a thing that you go on Twitter, you go on social media, and there's maybe a lot of things in the world that are not particularly positive. There are a lot of problems. And I always felt Eurovision is this sort of distinctly positive thing in the calendar where you just brings together. It is completely ridiculous, but everyone's aware of that. There's just an incredible positivity and sort of joy that I get from it.
There is some conflict there, because do you think that Jessica Malboy was robbed?
I was slightly disappointed by not from her performance in terms of, I mean, she's an incredible singer. I just think they didn't quite capture how you need to present that to a Eurovision audience.
I don't think it was one of her best songs, that's for sure.
No, I mean, but I don't think it's not really about the song. And I guess that's the thing that I feel Australia hasn't maybe quite captured, how to match like the amazing singing talent that we have. And I think every entrant we ever sent is of winning quality in terms of, you know, musicality and singing. But you need, it's not just that. And I think we haven't quite got that. And it'll be nice to not have a ballad. That's my personal, I'd love to not have a ballad next year, but,
Do you have a favourite winner from recent years?
Oh, I mean, she wasn't a winner, but I'm a huge Verka Sedechka fan from 2007, I think, 2006, from Ukraine. Tinfoil star on hat person dancing.
I don't know, I remember that one.
She popped back up when Ukraine hosted it last year, but she came second to Lordi. Was it Lordi that year that won? The heavy metal rockers.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you might know of Epic Sax Guy, maybe this sort of internet meme. It was Moldova of 2007 as well. And it had a saxophone player and everyone turned him into this internet meme. Became hugely one of those original, you know, 10-hour loop music videos where, you know, you'd take some snippet and you'll just loop it for 10 hours.
Right.
And, you know, sort of because he was sort of gyrating around with his saxophone. But they actually re-entered last year, like 10 years after they'd originally, and it was just this sort of amazing kind of very meta kind of moment because everyone knew, and of course the sax guy was back and he had a new song, and but it actually came, I think, third or something, kind of incredibly.
Oh.
And it was just this really, just really fun moment because everyone kind of recognized, you know, this thing that's sort of blown up. And it was sort of a very low, slow burn. I don't know if it even immediately after Eurovision, like 10 years ago, was really popular, but the internet kind of revived it as this meme, and then
yes.
You know, they came back and lent into that, and people actually liked it, and it was a really fun song. So those are the ones that sort of come to mind. But I mean, that's like picking your favorite child or something. I don't think I could.
Of course,
I just have a very long playlist of, you know, if I meet someone, because I mean, I guess the other thing is that's sort of funny living in the UK is you are actually the UK is not so bad because it's a bit of a cultural thing here, even if people aren't very enthusiastic about it. They all know about it. I spent a lot of time in mainland Europe, and my girlfriend is Czech, for example, and she had never seen Eurovision. You know, if you talk to some random people in Czech Republic, they wouldn't know what it is. So, you know, I have this sort of playlist of like, these are the things you have to understand what Eurovision is. You need to watch, you know, these 20 YouTube clips, and it'll give you a good background. So.
Well, look, I'm a huge fan. I've just got to name a couple. Lena with Satellite. I think that's my all-time favorite.
It's classic. Yeah, I can understand that.
Because, you know, I brought some underwear light blue and I wore it just the other day. And then the other one I love is Loreen, Euphoria.
Yeah,
a bit of EDM. I'll ask you this. I could talk about this for ages. Do you think that Toy was more a novelty song or a political statement? And what was the reason it won? Because it didn't do it for me, I must admit.
I was not surprised that it won. I think it had the perfect combination of something. It's quite memorable, which I think is very important now, especially now that all the songs get released. They have like kind of a month or 2 months beforehand for everybody to kind of listen to them. It was memorable. It stood out. It's the right type of song for, you know, it's light, it's fast-paced. I don't think people voting really were doing it politically. I mean, when I read an interview for if there was any sort of, you know, deeper thing, I mean, she was sort of trying to make some points related to sort of the Me Too movement, as I understand.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it was tied to Israeli national politics or something like that. Although, of course, you know, now there are a lot of people discussing kind of the impact of that win and what that means. And I mean, of course, Eurovision is no stranger. You know, it's always taken place in some sort of political context, which is kind of the richness of it. And, I mean, of course, Ukraine only just last year. It'll be interesting. I'm very interested what next year will be like. Actually, because I think, it was only last year, right, that Russia wasn't allowed to compete. And
that's exactly right. Look, we could talk all night about this, but I better bring you back to games. So now, obviously from Relic Runners we mentioned before, you had quite a few successes, some great games. One we liked here, Empire Engines, Pyramids, Diesel Demolition Derby, and of course, a little success with a game called Elysium. Now, can you tell us a bit about that journey with Elysium and the ensuing fame and attention that brought?
Yeah, Yeah, it's hard to know what it's going to become. I mean, when we sold the game, I mean, even that connection. So when we sold the game, Space Cowboys didn't really exist at that time. They hadn't. They were maybe about to release Splendor, but they hadn't yet.
Yep.
I think this was probably Essen, maybe Essen 2013. So we knew the people who had made up Space Cowboys because they were from Asmodee, and Brett Gilbert, who's the co-designer of Elysium, his first game, Divinare, was Asmodee. So that's kind of where we had that contact. So, but we didn't have any idea really of what this company would do. And I think, you know, looking back, you'd be like, oh, wow, you had this amazing opportunity to work with Space Cowboys. But of course, at that time, we had no idea really what we were getting to. We were just really glad they seemed so positive about the game. And certainly something that we learned in the development process, they are incredible developers. I mean, I think there's a reason Space Cowboys, you know, make sort of hit after hit, is that it's really a company composed of the most experienced publishers and developers in France, in a way. I think we were just really lucky that we got to work with them, and they put so much work into really improving every aspect of the game. So obviously the mechanically, but also thinking about the visual aspect in terms of, you know, the amazing artwork and the art direction and production quality and all these sort of things. So we really struck it very lucky with them. And then, you know, when the game was released, we were really fortunate that it found a home with a lot of people. I think when you release a game, you obviously think it's good, or, you know, better than good, but you can never predict how the community might react, and you just hope that it'll find a home with some people. And we were lucky that it was more people than we maybe expected, and that was really nice. And then getting a nomination for the Kenner Spiel des Jahres in 2015 was just really a nice icing on the cake. It was a very exciting thing to go there to Berlin to the ceremony and to really kind of see that up close is sort of interesting, because they take it quite seriously. I think we see it as this award, but actually it really is an event. They invite local local media.
Yeah, they have media coverage, don't they? Like live.
It really is a real kind of press event in a way. I don't think I had completely appreciated it, and maybe I'm not sure Phil may have talked about it as well with Imhotep. And what it's like. So that was really great. And I think even now, the fact that it has kind of lived on as long as it has, I mean, the sales obviously sort of decreased, but the fact that, you know, people still talk about it every now and then and seem to have fondness for it, I really think it's pretty much the only game so far that I've had that has really kind of kept any sort of life, you know, out, you know, beyond sort of 6 months, really. You know, the kind of churn of games is so quick, and it's hard to catch people's attention. And we were lucky to get that with Elysium. So yeah, I just feel very fortunate. I still enjoy playing the game myself. We designed an expansion for it that has unfortunately doesn't have any plans to be published as yet. Wow. But we are still working on it, and it's nice to we've been pretty open about it, and even it's nice that people in the community have responded well to that and have really, you know, encourage us and wanting us to find a way to release it. And so I'd say watch this space, but it might be a while. You know, these things sort of move slowly. And I think it takes some time to, when you think about if you were to try and find some way to, release new content, we'd have to, I'm not sure how that's going to work, but it does exist.
So. Okay. Now you've segued nicely, because I've just seen there is an expansion coming soon for Professor Evil. Now, to take a step back, I don't know if you're aware of the Kanger Awards. Have you heard of the Kanger Awards?
These aren't the Board Game Australia Awards.
So there is a group called Board Game Australia. They do have the Australian Board Game Awards, very creatively titled. but no, so there's a new set of game awards that have just been created this year. They're presented by the Australian Tabletop Media, of which we here at the Dice Men are a part. And so the judges are all working in the content production in Australian Tabletop Media. And we've created the Kangas to acknowledge, champion, and award Australian involvement in tabletop games. Now, we're going to be announcing the Kanga Awards later this year. Probably, I think we're going to do it at PAX Australia, which is last weekend in October, so probably just after Essen Spiel. I'm sure you'll be very busy there. But the thing about the Kanga Awards is any game with Australian involvement, so designer, producer, artist, or anything else, is eligible for a Kanga Award. Now, clearly, Professor Evil and the Citadel of Time has fitted in nicely to the time frame we're looking at for the 20... I think we're going from May 2017 to May 2018 as the sort of 12 months. Exciting news. That game is eligible for a Kanga Award. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm shocked and surprised. I'm pleasantly surprised. That would be nice. I think I think these awards, for me, they're nice things, but I don't think they compare even as much to just even reading a nice comment on Board Game Geek or even just people seeing people playing your game.
Yep.
And enjoying it. And I mean, obviously these awards recognize that on a sort of larger level.
Yeah, exactly. I guess we want to highlight what great work you Australians, are out there doing in this hobby, really punching above your weight. I wanted to ask you a little bit about this game. So we haven't managed to get it to the table. Well, we have done a bit of research about it, of course, for the Kanga Awards, and I'm actually hoping to play it this weekend. I'm heading to a game convention in Sydney. Now, you've had quite a bit of success with it, I think. Was it something that was a long time in development?
No, I think it was sort of an average amount of time. I mean, probably somewhere between 3 to 6 months. I mean, I don't work full-time on games, so, yep. You know, these things are sort of...
And this is you and Brett again, isn't it?
Yes, it's Brett and I again. I think we wanted to try our hand at cooperative games. I think we both had positive experiences, and I think it's always a nice sort of family setting, also for non-gamers to play. And so we definitely wanted something that could be pitched at, you know, sort of more casual gamers. I had some ideas about, like, a very basic AI to kind of control sort of the enemy or the game or as it was. And I think we were interested in how can you have the enemy, you know, a lot of these sort of cooperative games, the enemy is very abstract. I mean, you know, if you take Pandemic, I mean, it's hard to really personify a virus or to really think. It's a very sort of these global disasters.
Yeah.
And we were sort of, how can you make that a real character that you could really even think of as a player, even though it's obviously not a player, it's being controlled by an AI. And so I think that was really what birthed the kind of mechanics that became Professor Evil.
Okay. The other thing that struck me about it is, like, it's a great world and a great story. There's a lot of imagination behind it. How much of that did you bring forth, and how much came from the publisher?
It was a little bit of both. I have to admit that the world as it's presented really lies with Funforge. I think they have an incredible ability to, as you said, sort of imagine worlds and settings. Obviously the art from Bibbone is a huge part of that.
Mm. And oh, it's lovely.
He is incredible. We've been lucky enough in our latest game, Raids from Yellow, he's also done the art for that.
Oh, nice.
He's an incredibly talented guy and really, really nice guy as well. And I think their idea for, you know, this sort of steampunk kind of, you know, like kind of steampunk Cluedo almost kind of feeling. That being said, in our prototype that we did present, even though it was essentially color, you know, it was black and white, no art on the board or anything, it was called Professor Evil and I think it was And the Lost Treasures or something, or yeah. Professor Evil. We had this idea of the basic story was there in our prototype that, you know, it was this faintly absent-minded professor who was sort of stealing artifacts and you were trying to save them before he snatched them away forever. So I think the kind of the underlying theme was always there and Funforge just hit it out of the park in kind of realizing that and kind of filling in all the blanks and filling in this really rich world, actually, which I'm glad that in the new expansion we just get to explore a little bit more of. There'll be two new characters. Professor Evil will have a few new tricks that he can play. There'll be a few new sort of treasures. The professor's left a few of his own personal items around the Citadel and you can try and sort of steal them for small benefits. So I'm glad that we get to go back and see more of that world.
And do you think, are there plans at this stage for more expansion? Because obviously there, you know, there's so much you could explore. There's so much you could add with this. You could make a movie even.
Yeah, I think Brett and I certainly have some ideas and some things we've sort of thought about is that, well, if the professor can go anywhere in time, well, why don't we shift, you know, where he's doing his, you know, could we see where he's actually stealing the things and explore things that way. So we'll see. I think it will depend a little bit on how well the game goes. You know, as I said, it has sold sort of well initially, but it's hard to say how that will continue. And I think it's certainly more the exception than the rule that a game will, you know, sell for long enough to sort of support multiple expansions and things like that. But certainly hopeful, and we certainly have ideas. So fingers crossed. Hopefully, hopefully it'll win the Kangaroo Award, and then everyone. It'll, just like the Spiel des Jahres, you know, it'll sell 500,000 copies in Australia alone, and we'll release lots of expansions.
We can only dream, that's for sure. Now, so Matt, looks like you and Brett, you obviously get on very well, Brett Gilbert. I sort of looking at the litany of games you've got about to be released this year and next year. Just a few of them. So Roll for Adventure sounds very interesting. You've got Raids, you've got Fussball Duel, you've got Fairy Tile, Chocolate Factory, Monumental, and then obviously we mentioned the expansion for Professor Evil. Do you want to give us a little rundown of, maybe not all of those, but sort of the key ones of those that you're excited about?
There's different ones. So there's some that have already been released. I think actually something like Fairy Tile might also be something maybe you can consider for the Kangaroo Award, because it's a beautiful, very simple, almost children's game from Yellow, where you're sort of exploring really a fairy tale story, and they have these beautiful figurines, pre-painted figurines of a dragon, a knight, and a princess who are moving around this sort of mythical kingdom, and you know, it plays 15 to 20 minutes, and we're really proud of that to try. And again, it has this sort of beautiful stained glass window art from Miguel Combra, who did the art for Seven Wonders, for example.
Oh yeah, he's an amazing artist. Yes,
he's incredibly talented, and so I think it's a beautiful product. And actually, when you see children play it, it's actually really engaging, and the gameplay is, you know, simple and interesting. But even as gamers, or you know, more adults, it still provides something of an interesting kind of puzzle. So I'd recommend checking that one out. The one that you didn't mention was sort of Pioneer Days, which is from Tasty Minstrel.
Yes,
which is sort of Oregon Trail, the board game. Even though I think now there is actually coming out soon an actual Oregon Trail board game. But that was definitely somewhat of the inspiration for this, and sort of more for those Euro fans, probably the most Euro game I've made, and that's with Chris Marling, sort of some dice drafting, you know, variable player powers thing. So check out, Watch a Play did a really good video of that.
Okay.
So Raids is out right now. It's probably more what you'd expect from Brett and I. It's very interactive, light to medium kind of game for about 40 minutes, and sort of, someone described as Takedo meets Jamaica.
Oh.
It takes something of that Takedo mechanism where you're sort of moving on a circular track, the person in the back, but it kind of adds conflict into that. So, because of course you're Vikings, so you can fight each other for the spaces, so you can land on another space of someone else and fight them in a slightly abstract way. And it's not too mean. It's don't think of it as a sort of an aggressive game, but there's just a little bit more interaction there. So that's just got released this weekend, I think. Actually, it's hit stores in the US, and I'm sure it'll make its way to Australia.
Yeah.
So there's Roll for Adventure, which is only going to be in German for Essen, so that's going to be Cosmos's really big release. So it's our next cooperative game with Brett. It's sort of, I'd say it's our take on a sort of a dice rolling, dice placement cooperative game. Really good family game. Again, I think people like Professor Evil, it's certainly at the same kind of level. Personally, it's one of my favorite games we've made the last few years.
Awesome.
I play tested myself many, many times to sort of test the balance, and I never got sick of it. And there's lots of little fun things you can do in a really simple kind of rule set. So that's worked out well. And I guess the other big one that is the next thing from Funforge is Monumental.
Yes.
So that's a solo design. It's just myself, and it will be hitting Kickstarter in October.
Ooh.
So it's a civilization deck building game. Certainly the biggest game I've designed, but it has a really innovative, well, I think it's innovative, sort of a twist on deck building where you have what we're calling a cross tapping. So you, instead of having a hand of cards, you deal them out into a 3x3 grid. And you essentially select one row and one column of cards to activate on your turn. So it's sort of taking that deck building aspect, adding a little bit more strategic planning, a little bit more choice to it.
Okay.
And it seems, but that has been supported by Funforge, who I just said have amazing track record in production.
Yes.
And art. And they are just hitting it out of the park in terms of the beautiful miniatures that have been sculpted, the art. There's, I don't know how many different pieces of unique art there are in the game. It must be over 100 pieces of art. It's just incredible. So I'd recommend to check that out if you like. It's also trying to be a civilization game that can play in about an hour to an hour and a half. So
wow.
We hope that it pulls off that, and that it might appeal to people who sort of sort of like that.
Last time we talked, you talked about, you know, it was a challenge for you not to go down the rabbit hole working with Brett designing those small games because there's a quick turnaround time, they're really easy to play test, but how that can distract you from the bigger games. Clearly, you've come back from that rabbit hole now?
I guess so, but I don't think it... I mean, the thing I haven't really mentioned at all, I mean, which also kind of happened since we last spoke, is that Brett and I also have this website called Good Little Games.
Yes.
Which is a... I mean, it probably maybe exists... So Empire Engine, for example, came from Good Little Games originally. And we kind of revived it about 2 years ago and released 6 new games on that that were just between Brett and I. It's up to 27 cards or less and some sort of basic components, all sort of free print and play games. And we also had a Patreon trying to kind of support that. And it was an interesting experiment, actually. And so I don't think we've lost the interest for it. And I myself still really like those restrictions. I actually think we've made a lot of games. I was just talking last night with somebody about it. I sort of start with the restriction of, if you just have 110 cards, what kind of game can you make? How different can those games be?
Yes.
That you make? And for example, Pyramids came out of that thinking. Raids, strangely enough, also came out of that thinking. So originally it was cards that were set that made this kind of rondel. And there are 3 or 4 other games that we've made and that are at various stages of either being signed with publishers or almost with publishers.
Ooh.
That have explored that idea. And I don't think... I think what I suppose I've realized maybe since then is that it's not a problem to make what I would consider a smaller game because it's always easier to make that a bigger game with a publisher. And by that, I mean it can be expanded by either components or the world that you build around it. So you might think of it as this, you know, small 110 card game, but a publisher might think, oh, well, no, we can add some components to represent this, or we can add this art, or let's change these cards into tiles. And you still have the core gameplay experience, which is hopefully very rewarding and interesting, but you can have it in a slightly larger package that is maybe a little bit more usable. And I think it's not such a bad way to go anymore. I guess also since then, things like, you know, Splendor obviously has been very popular. That's essentially, you know, a deck of cards and some chips. Things like Majesty, like basically everything that Marc-André does, who's the designer of Splendor, I'm very impressed with. I think we've seen a resurgence in, I don't want to say smaller games, but games that I guess when you design them might seem small, like even something like Azul, it's a board and some, you know, could have just been some cubes, some colored cubes when you had a prototype. I don't know what Michael Kiesling made it with originally, but there's sort of been a resurgence in these kind of games, and I think it's not such a rabbit hole as I thought it was. I think it's just finding the right publishers to work with to really add value to that experience and especially through components. And we're now seeing really some publishers really pushing the envelope of what's possible at a particular price point, you know, with particular components.
Yeah, and people like Emerson Mitsuki with those smaller games where they pack quite a bit of punch, but, you know, you can still play them under an hour. I mean... Everyone's short of time these days. I know we certainly are, and I'm sure you are with all the things you're up to. So you're right, to be able to pack in a punch, but get it in under an hour, there is a real sweet spot there, that's for sure.
Yeah, and Brett and I think are completely on that level of that's what we like to design. It's that, you know, 30 to 60 minute games, good, clear interactions, clear rule sets, hopefully some interesting, you know, theme or take on what you're doing, but there you can get that really that nice gaming hit in as an efficient way as possible, I guess.
Yeah, okay. And now I've got to ask you, obviously, Eschenspiel coming up later this year. Now, we're not quite as famous enough to get there yet, but you would have been a few times now?
Yeah, I guess I've been. I mean, that's where I met Brett Ridge, 2011. So this will be my 8th Essen, I think, this year.
And so for you, do you spend much time walking around, looking at other people's games, playing games, or is it really that shopping trip for you where you're shopping yourself and you're your stable of prototypes to the game manufacturers all over Europe?
Yeah, it's much more the latter now. But I've certainly seen the whole transition. You know, obviously the first time I went to Essen, I hadn't really designed much. I mean, I had Relic Runners, what would become Relic Runners, but I wasn't showing it to publishers. So I was just there as a punter. And then Brent and I started co-designing. I think next year we went back, we had one game. And I think we took maybe 3 or 4 meetings with different publishers just showing this one game. Fast forward to last year, where we had probably 30 meetings, I think. Wow. And it's also not limited now to just pitching our prototype. Sometimes it'll be a company has already signed our game and really we're meeting to discuss the production or some development on the game, or we're discussing how it's sort of that project is progressing. And I think part of that is just the way how the industry works. You know, there's obviously some time lag between, you know, signing a game and it being released, and a lot of stuff happens in between. And I think if you hang around and you keep designing, then slowly you get more and more things overlapping, and you sort of have more work to do with more publishers, if you're lucky enough. And I feel I've really been lucky in that regard. So yes, it's much more meeting and business. I think we probably had 2 hours spare to kind of have a look at. You see stuff as you're walking from meeting to meeting.
Yes.
That's our experience, and I think that we're used to that. And it's obviously not like that for everybody. You always hear so much about how great the board game community is. And for us, in the kind of the small subsegment of interacting with the representatives of the various publishers, I would say over the years they've become good friends, actually. You know, we meet them once or twice a year. It's just actually a lot of fun, those meetings now. I don't think they're, you know, there's obviously a business component to it, but we're just happy to sort of catch up and even just chat and then get to some games. And I guess that's something to, if anyone's thinking of designing or getting into it, I mean, that's something maybe you forget. At the end of the day, you're just, it's all about, in a lot of businesses, it's just about relationships. It's about building a relationship with people. And even if you don't have the product that matches what they're looking for at that moment, you're still working on that relationship with them, and you don't know where that might lead in the future. So I've been glad to be able and being able to go to Essen every year, you know, being over here helps to kind of maintain those relationships. It's, you know, obviously a lot harder if you're further away.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you have fallen beautifully into my trap, because on the Cambridge University website, it states that you're interested in combining high-throughput theoretical computational screening methods with various spectroscopic and physical properties measurement to predict new candidates for functional materials. But who knows what that actually means? I put it to you, Matthew. You're actually interested in combining high-throughput board game mechanics with various game design principles and play methodologies to predict new candidates for board gaming awards. Or you're about ready to make the jump to full-time game designer, are you?
It certainly
not that,
is on
not
my
that
mind.
I want to, not that I want, you know, Cambridge to hear this and, who am I kidding? They're not going to listen.
No. If anyone plays Pioneer Days, actually my PhD supervisor is one of the characters in the game. So she certainly is aware of what I've been doing. And actually I've started to explore using games and science together. So I've actually made a board game for the synchrotron in the UK now to try and teach people about how the synchrotron works, for example.
Wow.
But to your actual question, it's certainly something on my mind. I'm currently looking at my next move in academia and seeing how I could sort of balance that with games. I'm very lucky that the games are going well and academia is going well, and I've been trying to balance it as best I can. Whether I'll be able to continue doing that, or I know that I will want to keep designing games for the rest of my life, no matter what. So I think it's just finding the best way to do that. You know, I talk to a lot of people I talk to people like Phil Walker Harding. I've been working with Bruno Cathala on some games. We'll, a small teaser, we will have a co-design coming out next year.
Ooh.
A small two-player game. And talking with those people about, you know, what it means to be a full-time designer and kind of the practicalities of that. It's a tough gig, actually. I mean, even with all the luck and the fortune I've had, it doesn't necessarily compare to having a full-time job with a regular paycheck and all the sort of the living costs you have. And I think the other thing you don't realize, you're essentially a freelancer, and I think it comes with all the kind of the stress and uncertainty that has. I mean, again, the way the industry is working, it's maybe have a bit more certainty that you'll find a publisher for a game because there are more publishers out there, and Kickstarter sort of has facilitated that. But the sales, I think, are much more unpredictable in terms of, you know, what's the longevity of that. So I don't foresee going full time in the near future. Whether it means I really become definitely part-time, because I'm not really definitely part-time either, whether I really try and carve off time to properly work on games, it definitely is becoming a thing where I have a lot of things shouting for my attention more than I had before. You know, when you only had one game at a time or in a year or something, well, it's easy to kind of fit that into the evenings and work on something. But, you know, when you've got 5 or 6, you know, releasing in a year, it sort of starts becoming more of a, you've got to kind of feed the beast constantly. So, and I like doing it. I'm going to visit Brett this weekend in a few days. And often what I'll do is I'll just work on four or five just new ideas and quickly make first prototypes that I can show him, and we can start thinking about new things. And I've got to kind of do that for the first time in a while, and it's still a lot of fun just to kind of think of things out of the blue and see what you can do. So we'll see. I'm thankful that I've been able to do it this long with the balance that I've had. So
yeah. Oh no, that's awesome. You know, of course I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but clearly with the volume of games you've got coming out, you know, there's a huge amount of work there, that's for sure.
It's a timely question. It's certainly something that is very much on my mind. So, but we'll see.
Cool. You mentioned a game coming out with Bruno, who he's one of our favourite non-Australian designers, that's for sure. We love his work. Is there anything else you can tease us that's coming up soon that you're excited about?
I wish I could talk about it, and it's not announced, but I'm hopeful that I will have a game with Phil Walker-Harding.
Ooh.
That hopefully will see the light early next year. Very excited for this project, actually. It's sort of a continuation of it. There's been a very popular trend in board games, maybe over the last couple of years, board games that maybe you only play once.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we have a project that is sort of looking at the continuation of that. I wouldn't say it's exactly what's come before, but it's going along those lines. So
that is super exciting.
Yeah, and it's been great. I mean, I'm a huge shout out. I mean, you've talked to Phil. I mean, he's an amazing guy. I came back to Australia last Christmas, and we just met up just twice, actually, and just with the idea to try and work on some games. And that came two games, one of which hopefully will be this one will be coming out next year. And it was just such a great experience working on these. He's just, well, firstly, he's not one of the nicest guys I've met, but also just incredibly professional and such a hard worker. And I think the same if you someone like Bruno Cathala is exactly the same, incredibly friendly, but also just an absolute consummate professional in terms of the way they approach design and just generally getting the work done.
Yeah.
And I've really been lucky that they've probably feel unfortunate they've been saddled with me and always I'm like being respond to things, but that they've both been really great experiences. And I've been going to visit Bruno now for a few years. I go to, he's kind enough to invite me to his house, and I go there for a weekend and we sort of noodle around things, and it's just a nice life, actually, at the end of the day. It's nice just to catch up with people.
Yeah, all we need you to do is get Ian O'Toole on board for the art, and that would just be the Australian dream team right there.
Actually, the thing that you would know a lot better than I, because really in the time that I've been away from Australia, is I really have kind of missed the blossoming of Australian publishing,
yes,
as far as I understand it. I feel a bit of an outsider, sadly, now kind of looking in and how sort of PAX has maybe facilitated that in some ways. But there's one company that maybe I'll have a game with an Australian publisher, maybe. We've sort of been talking about a few things, but it's certainly something I'd love to. If there are any Australian publishers out there, I would absolutely love to kind of reconnect with that community.
Yeah,
actually.
Well, there you go. There's the challenge. Now, before I let you go, a couple more super quick questions. I know you've given me your attention. I really appreciate it. So what game that's not designed by you are you excited about at the moment?
I'm a large fan of Azul. Probably one of the most played games I've got recently.
Yep.
I hope it will win the Spiel des Jahres.
Oh, me too.
Although it will be... It's an interesting year, actually. I think it'll be fine whether it wins or not. It's already done very well.
Yep.
So that's something I'm excited about, so I think.
Before we go on, what's your pick in the Kennerspiel?
I have played Gun Shon Clever
a
couple of times, although once I think I played within the correct rules because we were trying to work out German. And I've only seen a video of Quacksalber, and you're going to have to remind me what the third game is, actually.
You've made me forget even. No, that's... Oh, Heaven and Ale.
Oh, of course, yes, Heaven and Ale. Yeah, so I haven't played either of the other two. I just don't know. I think it'll be Quacksalber if I had to make just a guess.
Good pick.
Looking at what they've rewarded in the last couple of years, I think that kind of lines up with that. But I don't know. Have you played the game?
Yeah, so we played all three. We were lucky enough to play all three of them at BorderCon. Heaven and Ale for me was just a series of score tracks. and as a home brewer, I was so disappointed that you're gathering all these ingredients and you never actually turn them into beer.
It's disappointing, isn't it?
It's just very unsatisfying. And then Gun Shon Clever. Look, you know, it's interesting. I actually quite enjoyed it, particularly as a two-player.
Yeah, I think four players for me was too... It's just too...
A bit too random.
Well, it's also just too long, I think. Yeah. But so I agree. I think a two-player game would be very good.
Yeah, whereas I think Quacksalber is perfectly in the middle. You know, we sat down, we had an absolute ball within it. We played it probably in just over an hour, almost all new players. Just a lot of fun and light, but then it's got the bag building, which is a thing at the moment. Yeah, I just think it ticks all the boxes, just like Azul does. The very first time I played it, before it had been nominated, my first thought was, oh, this is a perfect Spiel game.
Yes, but I think now it's interesting, but what do you think of the Maya then is the real question.
Matthew, you would have to go back and listen to...
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think
yeah,
it was episode 217.
Okay.
We spent a lot of time talking about it. Let's just say, spoiler alert, we didn't like it much.
Yeah, I'm afraid I might be a little bit on your side, but I can appreciate the design of it. So I think it's going to be an interesting thing because I think there are very strong opponents for both camps, and I think it will be an interesting choice for the jury because it is kind of a different... Either of them winning would be a... I think it would showcase off some really great design.
I think the mind is more of an experience than a game. That's the thing.
Well, I would argue Hanabi is a little bit like that as well.
Yeah.
I think board gaming is moving a little bit towards more valuing experience. Mechanics aren't as important now. I think the rise of, you know, escape room games, for example.
Yes, exactly.
They say something to that. And I think the jury and I think gamers are realizing that. I think it's a great time to be designing because designers are showing us that huge range of experiences you can have with just some cards or cardboard or whatever. And I guess I think we're on the same side, but no matter what the mind, what you think of the mind, I think it really does further even people just understanding what's possible. I really have to, you know, tip my hat to Wolfgang for that.
Now, so sorry, I interrupted you. Did one pop into your mind apart from Azul? A game that you're excited about that's not yours at the moment?
So yeah, it was basically Azul, and I was racking my mind actually trying to think of a game I have played. I play quite a lot of two-player games with my girlfriend, and we just discovered the game The Jewel. So it's a two-player version of the game.
Oh, yes.
So like that, the card game that was released by ESV, I think it was nominated for the Spirit of Errors, I think.
Yes.
And actually, it's really, really good. I've been in Germany recently, and I love whenever I go to Germany, I always go to because you just go to a random toy store, and they actually have a huge wall of games. You know, like if you went to Toys R Us in Australia, you would see Monopoly and all sorts of Hasbro stuff. But in Germany, it's like, oh, you've got all the Cosmos stuff, and you know, you've got this amazing wealth of stuff. So I always go there, and it's all really quite affordable, actually. So I love picking up like these. I just see these little card games, and I try and pick them up, and I picked up this just having no idea how it played, and it's a really fun distillation of the game, but in a really nice sort of two-player shell. So if people like two-player games, I would recommend checking this one out. I have no idea how available it is outside of Germany.
Yeah, I'm just trying to find it on Board Game Geek, and of course, you know how difficult it is to find the game. The game. It looks like the English version is called The Game Face to Face.
Yes, that sounds right, yeah.
Okay, I don't know about the English release. It looks like there potentially might be one soon, but yeah, that sounds interesting.
You can definitely get, I mean, I bought the German copy, and ESV is always really good in that. All the rules are available on their website in I think, six different languages, and it's completely language-independent, it's a game. So, yeah, anyone who can get onto Amazon.de or German thing, I'd recommend checking that one out. I've enjoyed it.
All right, now, one final question I'm going to let you go. So what's it like to be in England at the moment as a foreigner when the World Cup's on and England now only two games away from holding up the trophy? Are they unbearable?
No, it's not unbearable at all. I mean, I was obviously a bit heartbroken watching Australia do as they did. I mean, it was not completely unexpected, and I think they did well. But no, I think it's exciting. It's just like we were talking about Eurovision. I mean, it's great to be part of that kind of excitement. I was lucky enough actually to be in Belgium the night that England lost to Belgium. It was just a really fun environment to be in as Belgium won. So I'm excited. I will definitely try and catch the match this evening. I'll know what's happening because I'll hear the roar if any goal scored echoing across the ground. Yeah, but I just enjoy it. I guess I'm a person who's interested in football basically around the World Cup. So. Yeah. I don't feel a foreigner. I think it's just a bit of fun. And actually, in Australia, I guess we don't have many sports where we have this history of sort of dominance, but been so long since sort of really gaining, you know, recognition in that sport.
That's right. 1966, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So I think, yeah, for a lot of people, it holds quite a bit of importance, and it's nice to when you see someone's passionate about something, that's always great to share in. So.
Well, and I think as well, if it's a France England final, I mean, there are not many longer rivalries in the history of the world than France and England, really.
Yeah, I would have liked Belgium to win personally, but yeah, we'll see. It'll be exciting nonetheless. I'm sure it'll be. Hopefully, the English fans are better well behaved than they were after the last match.
That's the thing, is it could turn ugly. That's for sure.
Yeah, but there's a lot of sensible people, so hopefully they'll prevail.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, it's very exciting. I mean, as we're recording this, we'll know who the other finalist is in about another 6 or 7 hours.
Yeah, something like that. I think the match starts probably in about 7 hours. So yeah, in about 9 hours, you'll know. So of course, when all the listeners are hearing this, they'll be like, "Why? When did they ever think as England could win?" You know, they'll have known the result, or maybe it'll be incredible prescience. We should record. What do you think? So who was England, France? What's your goal? What would be your scoreline for the final?
I think it's going to be 2-1. What's his name? Mbappe from France has been incredible. I mean, we didn't really see him when he played against Australia, but he could set the place on fire. But England, you know, they've really brought it all together. I guess, you know, as someone from the colonies, I think England do deserve a win after all these years. But I reckon it could be a very close game, and it could be 2-1 England.
All right. Well, I'll make it slightly. I'll say it's 1-1 and England wins on penalties.
Oh my goodness, that would certainly a lot of people would have their hearts in their mouths, because we know England haven't got a great history with penalties, that's for sure.
Well, but that would just think of the what it's like, the secret, right? You just have to think of it and put it out in the universe that'll happen.
Fantastic. Look, Matthew, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much. I'm really excited for listeners to hear all this great stuff from you. Please keep in touch with us. We'll keep in touch with you. You should definitely check out facebook.com/Kanga Awards.
I will.
Give you the down low on that. And that'll be coming later this year. And it's something obviously you can have an ongoing interest in, being an Australian. I'm really excited about your work with Phil Walker-Harding. I'm not going to use the L word, but that's extremely exciting for me. And look, all the best for Essen and your new releases. And thanks again for chatting with me today. It's been really lovely to talk to you.
No, thank you very much, Mark.
You've been listening to another episode of The Dice Men Cometh. Thanks to Area 52, Hobart's best ventilated game store, and more. Find out more on area52.com.au. They support The Dice Men, and you can too, at Patreon, for as little as just $1 per month. It's not a lot to ask for podcasting gold.